2 Corinthians chapter 6 is where we are picking up Paul's, to us, second letter to the Corinthians. Keep in mind, the chapter divisions didn't come until long after these letters were written. And so, we have to be careful going from one chapter to the next, thinking that somehow a new chapter means a new thought. Many times it does not. And as is the case here, as we get into chapter 6, Paul is very much dealing with the same issues that he dealt with in chapter 5, which you'll remember, those of you that were here with us last week. We talked about the fact, and Paul was talking to the Corinthians about the fact, that we are Christ's representatives, his ambassadors to the world, and we are to bring a message of reconciliation. And that, of course, is a message that God has given to us, saying that he has reconciled the world to himself through Jesus Christ, his Son, and now we can share that ministry, that message of good news and so forth. But the question kind of begs to be asked, did you and I receive this ministry to go out and share that gospel because we were good enough? Or was it because God saw something special in us? Well, no, it was purely an act of grace that he gave that to us. And that's what Paul's going to kind of talk about here. Before we talk about it, meaning grace, here for a moment, I want to just remind you that grace is defined as unmerited or undeserved favor. So if someone bestows favor upon you, and it is completely undeserved on your part, in fact, you perhaps even deserve the opposite, that's grace. Okay? Keep that in mind as you read with me in verse 1. As God's fellow workers, we urge you not to receive God's grace in vain. We'll talk about what that means in a moment. For he says, in the time of my favor I heard you, and in the day of salvation I helped you. A quote there from Isaiah. And Paul then says, I tell you, now is the time of God's favor. Now is the day of salvation. Well, obviously, whenever God bestows something on us through grace, purely out of grace, we've got to be careful not to receive it in vain. But there's a question that probably we need to even ask. What does it mean to receive something in vain? I mean, what does it mean to say it's in vain? Well, vain has different meanings, obviously, and certainly depending on how you spell it even. This is V-A-I-N. But it's not talking about vanity or conceitedness. To do something or to receive something in vain, in this sense of the word, means to be unproductive of success. Some of you, I'm sure, have been watching the Olympics. I particularly like to watch the track and field because I used to do track and field when I was in school, you know, and that was always fun. But I remember doing the long jump. Anybody else do the long jump? Yeah. If you run down that track and you know you have a spot that you have to leave the ground by, and if you go over that spot even the slightest bit, if your foot just touches that area, that's called a scratch. At least that's what we called it in school. That's, you know, and your jump is disqualified. In other words, you jumped in vain. Okay? It was an unproductive jump. It was unproductive of success, if you think of it that way. So when Paul says, let's be careful not to receive the grace of God in vain, he means to receive God's undeserved favor, but be unproductive of success. In other words, it produces nothing in our lives of any kind of fruitfulness and so forth. And so you have to answer yet another question. How would we do that? How is it possible to receive God's grace and still be unproductive with it? To still be ineffectual and so forth? How is that possible? Well, there are many reasons. Paul is going to outline just one of them in the next verse, verse 3. Look at that with me. He says, we put no stumbling block in anyone's path so that our ministry will not be discredited. And I have to think that this is probably one of the biggest reasons right here why we become unproductive in God's grace is because our ministry becomes discredited because of something in our lives, something perhaps we have said or done, something we haven't said or done. And you might think, well, good thing I don't have a ministry because I can't be discredited then. Well, I got news for you. Your ministry is just to live Christ in your daily life, wherever you may be. Home, work, school, doesn't matter. That's your ministry. Your ministry is to reflect the love of Christ, the light of Christ, the truth of Christ, the person of Christ. Now, do we do it perfectly? No. No, none of us do. We're not, we're not kidding ourselves here. And so when I'm talking about making yourself unproductive in God's grace and in that ministry that you have to share that grace with others, I'm not talking about living a perfect life. Please understand. There should be changes in our lives that should be consistent with our confession. But I think we make ourselves unproductive when our lives have absolutely no relationship to our confession. In other words, we go around talking about Jesus, we talk about church, we talk about the Bible, but our lives are not consistent with that talk and that confession of Christ. Then, I believe, as Paul says here, we put a stumbling block in people's ways. We put a stumbling block, and we actually can discredit our ministry. And someone might look at you and say, well, you know, you talk about being a Christian a lot, but I have really yet to see anything in your life that would display something consistent with that talk. And that's something we all have to be very, very careful of. Again, I want to remind you that this is not some sort of an exhortation for perfection. In fact, I will even go so far as to say that when we make mistakes, I didn't say if, notice, but when, because we do, I believe that that presents us with a marvelous opportunity to portray Christ. Let me give you kind of a quick example. A young man comes into my office and he says, Pastor Paul, and I can see that he's dejected and he's depressed. And he comes in and he says, Pastor Paul, I blew it this week. And I say, what happened? So he starts to tell me about how at work that week something happened that really made him mad. I mean, he really got angry. And I say, well, you know, getting angry isn't such a bad deal. He says, well, yeah, but man, I kind of vented my anger. And I got to be honest with you, a lot of things came out of my mouth that shouldn't have. I mean, a lot of obscenities. And man, I was swearing a blue streak. And I work with a lot of unbelievers and they heard all that. And I just really blew my witness. And I come back and I say, not necessarily. Yeah, you messed up. Yeah, you messed up. No question about that. But you know, when we mess up, and we do, we are then presented with a second opportunity to walk in godliness. Because I believe that one of the most important things we can do to the people who are watching us live our Christian lives is to let them know that, number one, we are fallible, but number two, we're humble enough to admit it and to apologize. And so I would encourage a young man like that, why don't you go back to where you work and why don't you walk up to the guys that heard you swearing that blue streak you talked about, and why don't you say, you know, I shouldn't have done that. I lost my temper and that was wrong of me and I apologize. Now, that's going to seem weird to people that you work with who don't know the Lord, because they probably have that stuff coming out of their mouth all the time. And they're used to hearing that stuff, and they probably weren't even offended when you did it. That's not the point. That's not the point. The point is you knew it was wrong, and so now you have the opportunity to go back and say, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have spoken like that. Let me tell you something. That's going to get their attention. That is going to get their attention. They're used to hearing cursings. They're not used to hearing somebody come and apologize after the fact. I really believe that what that shows people is real Christianity. Not some picture of Christianity that we want people to see that somehow is this, you know, we're the perfect family, you know. Husband, wife, and 1.2 children. You know. We have the perfect marriage. This is us. Look up perfect marriage and it says, see Paul and Sue. And we have the perfect children. Yeah, none of those things are true. And yet, so I believe that subconsciously there's a great many believers that have this, that carry this burden around as if that's the, that's what they gotta portray. No, we're okay, we're fine, we're good. Really, we're good. Fine. Really. And we're not. Sometimes we're not just fine. Sometimes we mess up. Sometimes we mess up big. Sometimes God lets us splash it all over. Well, then what are you going to do? Go move to a new town? Well, I guess I can't witness anybody for the Lord or here anymore. I got to get out of here. No. You keep living your walk with the Lord. You show him a real life version of Christianity that goes back to the people that, saw you fail, and you say, I failed. I messed up. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have said that. And they're probably going to think you're weird. But you know what? That's not the point. They're probably going to say something like, what are you apologizing for? And you come back and you say, well, because it was wrong. And I shouldn't have done it. Do you know what that begins to convey to that person? That this Christianity thing that he's living or she's living, this is for real people. This isn't just for perfect people. Because, you know, if we never convey to people that we make mistakes, we present a form of Christianity that really isn't very consistent with the Bible even. And we begin to almost convey a sense to them that Christianity is for perfect people, and they, and you'd be surprised how many people actually believe that. You talk to people about, you know, coming to church, and they'll say things like, well, you know, when I get my act together a little bit, I'll start coming to church. What's up with that? None of the rest of us have our act together, and we're there. You know what I mean? What's this thing about getting your act together? Well, see, what they're doing is they're communicating to you a particular mindset that in some cases we have been guilty of portraying to people. That it's special people that go to church. And you know what we're supposed to be conveying? That we're sinners. And we're saved by grace. And we're forgiven. Far from perfect. It's Him who's the perfect one, not us. And that, my friends, is real Christianity. I have labored in my heart as a pastor to endeavor to raise children who would come to a place of loving the Lord, because I know what pastors' kids normally, how they normally turn out. And you do too. Usually it's the PKs, right? Who are hellions. And I really believe, I mean, I decided at one particular point that one of the reasons why PKs go so bad so often is because they see a life that doesn't match up with a confession. They see hypocrisy. Dad's in the pulpit going, love God! And he goes home and slams doors and yells at his wife and smacks the kids around. And what are the kids going to think? This is fake. This is a bunch of baloney. And the first chance they get, they're out the door, you know, like a shot. So I decided early on that the best thing I could do for my children was to live a life of real Christianity. And that means confessing to them when I make a mistake. Not being worried that it's going to make me look like a weakling, but rather relishing in the fact that it's going to make me look real. And so my kids have gotten used to Dad coming up and saying, I messed up. I shouldn't have spoken to you that way. I'm sorry I bit at you. I'm sorry I was in a bad mood yesterday and I said things I should. I apologize. And you know, I have to tell you that so far, I think that the Lord has blessed that attitude of just simply conveying a real Christianity. Not putting a stumbling block in their way, but rather portraying and modeling a kind of Christianity that's real, that the kids can say, I can do that, because that kind of Christianity is all about just living and loving
and recognizing when you're wrong and confessing it, you know? And, you know, your kids look at that and they go, I can do that. I can do that. But you portray this picture of perfection. They're going to look at that and say, nobody can do that. Why even try? So, again, I want to say here, please understand that I am not offering an excuse for we as Christians to live any way we like and just kind of excuse ourselves in the name of, sorry, I'm not perfect, sort of a thing. I'm not saying that. I believe that our lives ought to reflect the changes that are going on, that Jesus is doing in our hearts through His Word. But when we do make mistakes, the people around us should be accustomed to hearing us apologize. Verse 4 goes on, and the apostle says, rather as servants, we commend ourselves in every way. And now Paul is going to talk a little bit here about the reality of his Christian life, and I want to bring you back to the understanding of something very important about this letter that we call 2 Corinthians. People, it might not sound like it on the outside, but this is a love letter. I mean, this is as passionate as Paul has ever gotten in any of his New Testament letters. And here's why. The people in Corinth were probably the most difficult people for Paul to really win their heart. And the reason is because other leaders had made their way into the church at Corinth and they were doing everything they could to discredit Paul as a person and as a minister of the gospel and an apostle. And they were succeeding. And the people in Corinth, for the most part, were backing away and kind of pushing back, pulling back, and saying, you know, I don't know about this Paul guy. And yet Paul was doing his best to love them. Now, I want you to think about that for just a little bit. Because if we're going to all be honest with ourselves here this morning, we're going to admit that it's really not very fun to hang around people that don't like us. Right? I don't like being around people that don't like me. I would rather spend time with people who love me. Right? Because people who love you are very forgiving. Very warm. Smile a lot. You know, pat you on the back and make you feel good. People that don't like you are looking for any reason they can find to call attention to your faults. What was that? Did you think that was funny? Or something, you know, just nitpicking. Isn't that just human nature, just to want to be around people that like you? Paul is writing a letter to a group of people that didn't particularly like him. But he loved them. And he wasn't going to give up. And so he begins to speak in these next several verses about the things he put up with on a day-to-day basis to say to those people, I love you. And here's what he says. I'll start again in verse 4. Rather, as servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way, in great endurance, in troubles, hardships, and distresses, in beatings, imprisonments, and riots, in hard work, sleepless nights, and hunger, in purity, understanding, patience, and kindness, in the Holy Spirit and in sincere love, in truthful speech and in the power of God, with weapons of righteousness in the right hand and in the left, through glory and dishonor, bad report and good report. And by the way, Paul had gotten a lot of bad reports by these leaders in Corinth. Genuine, yet regarded as imposters. Paul had been regarded as an imposter to the Corinthians. Known, yet regarded as unknown, like you don't even know him. Dying, and yet we live on. Beaten and yet not killed, sorrowful yet always rejoicing, poor yet making many rich, having nothing and yet possessing everything. Wow, that's a pretty incredible resume, isn't it? But can you imagine going through those things just to convey to a group of people that you love them? I can't. I think I'd have written them off. I mean, and I don't say that to be funny. I say that because I think it's really what I would probably have done. I would have written them off. And, I mean, to go to prison for these people? I mean, to go to Corinth and do it. It's like, you know, hey, I'm not going to go to Corinth and risk myself there. Those people are dopes. You know, they won't open their hearts, and they're just being, you know, just real stiff-necked about the whole thing. And I've poured out my love to them, and they haven't poured it back in response. And so we're not going to Corinth anymore. I'll risk, if I'm going to risk my neck, I'll risk it in a place where the people love me, so that I'll feel like at the end of the day, when I maybe have had my daily 39 lashes or whatever I've gone through that day, at least I can say it was for something. You know what I mean? It was for some good. At least I can say that. Can't say that with the Corinthians. I labor and I strive and I go through all this stuff, and for what? They turn up their nose. They turn their backs. That's the kind of a situation Paul was dealing with. But rather than just saying, okay, we're not going to do Corinth, Paul just labored over these people and loved them and took time to write these passionate letters to them about his love and desire for them. And he even turns up the heat here in verse 11 when he says, "We have spoken freely to you, Corinthians, and have opened wide our hearts to you." He says, "We're not withholding our affection from you, but you are withholding yours from us." And so then he says in verse 13, "As a fair exchange, I speak to you as my children here. Open wide your hearts also." Wow. That's the heart of a father who loves his child and yet is being spurned. And that child is kind of running off in his or her youthful, rebellious ways. And yet the father is passionately pursuing the child and saying, "I love you. I love you. And I will not let go. Because I love you so much." This is such a powerful example of the kind of love that the Apostle Paul portrayed. And it's so easy, isn't it, just to write people off? It's so easy. But how about loving people when they don't love you back? I think that's a real sign of God doing something special in our hearts, don't you think? So again, he exhorts them to open wide their hearts. Now, again, I'll remind you, the reason that they'd closed their hearts to Paul was because of these leaders. Paul called them false teachers. And so, rather than embracing these people who come to influence them negatively, Paul then says the following in verse 14. He says, "Do not be yoked together with unbelievers. For what do righteousness and wickedness have in common?" What do they have in common? Righteousness, wickedness. You got one on one side, one on the other. What do they have in common? How about try nothing? Aren't they polar opposites? Yeah. He says, "Or what fellowship can light have with darkness?" You can't have light and darkness in the same place. One displaces the other. He says, "What harmony is there between Christ and Belial?" And the word Belial is an interesting Greek word that literally means a worthless, wicked person. And it became kind of a pseudonym for Satan himself eventually. So it's like Paul is saying, what does Christ have in common with Satan? He says, what does a believer have in common with an unbeliever? What agreement is there between the temple of God and idols? For we are the temple of the Holy Spirit. He says, the temple of the living God. As God has said, "I will live with them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people." Now, this is interesting. He's saying, what do these things have in common with one another? They don't have anything in common. And so he says, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. Now, what's Paul saying to us exactly? Is he saying have nothing to do with people outside the church, people who are unbelievers? No, he's not saying that. Because you'd have to leave the earth to do that. You have to go set up housekeeping on the moon. But you know what? Pretty soon, it would follow you there. So, what is he saying? The key people is in that word yoked. Now, simple word, yoked. It's a word that Paul's hearers would have easily understood because it was a very common part of their everyday practice. To go anywhere, If you're going to bring a cart or if you're going to plow your fields or whatever, you've got to yoke your animals to the cart. And the yoke was literally an apparatus that fit over the neck of the animal, usually a beast of burden, typically an oxen or a donkey or possibly even a horse, something like that, but by which they would pull the cart or the plow or whatever. Now, what happens when two animals are unequally yoked? In other words, you have one animal who's strong and experienced and knows what it is to pull a cart, and you've got another animal who's brand new and never done it before. First time. You put this yoke, this double yoke on both of them, hook them up together, hook it up to the cart and say, yeah! What's going to happen? The one who knows how to pull and is stronger and so forth begins to pull, and the other one just sits there. Just sits there. Well, you know what happens if one pulls and the other doesn't? You go in circles. You go in circles. You get nowhere. Because there is an unequal yoke that is going on. And the fact that it is unequal, Paul is laying emphasis on the fact that you're dealing with someone who doesn't know the Lord. Now, an unequal yoke can occur in many, many different ways. This passage is often applied to marriage, which it is applicable to, but it goes far beyond that. I mean, you could be unequally yoked in business. Okay? Meaning that if I have a great business idea, but no money to back it up, and I go and I look for somebody to subsidize my business, and I finally find somebody to subsidize my business, and he says, hey, that's a great idea, Paul. I'll get behind you financially on that, and we'll make this thing fly. Only one problem. He's not a believer. Well, it's not going to probably be a problem at first. But then eventually, our differences of understanding of the way we deal with things like the law and ethics, other aspects of morality are going to seep their way in. And pretty soon down the road, I come to my business partner. I say, hey, it's time to file taxes. And he says, well, we're not going to do it this year. Excuse me? Yeah, we're not going to file taxes this year. And why? Well, because we'd take too big of a hit. Oh, don't worry. We'll get away with it. See the problem? Or we're going to buy this, or we're going to spend money for that, or let's branch out into doing more of this. Yeah, but that's immoral. Oh, come on. The people are making money, good money, doing this. Don't you want to win? Listen, if I'm going to be behind you and financially help this business, then you need to take my direction in this. See, the problem is we've got a different worldview. We have a whole different way of looking at life and business and practices and morality and ethics. And on it goes. And whether we're dealing with a business situation or even a friendship or marriage, the Bible says do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. Because when there's an unequal yoke, there's going to be problems. There's going to be problems. And it's something that we need to start taking seriously. You know, I remember a number of years ago, a long time ago, almost probably 20 years ago, I sat down with a group of kids. I'd love to talk to them now because they're all in their mid-30s now. But they were teenagers at the time, 15, 16 years old. And I started sharing from this passage about the unequal yoke and what it meant. And I tell you, they couldn't roll their eyes fast enough. I mean, they wanted to communicate to me in no uncertain terms that I was the biggest idiot that ever got off the latest spaceship from Mars. And what in the world are you talking about? You know, sort of a thing. And yet, I dare say there's a good number of Christians, maybe even some in this room, who, if they were given the opportunity, could stand and tell you what it's like to be unequally yoked with an unbeliever. If there are some young women in our fellowship who are contemplating marriage or even dating, courting, whatever you want to call it, an unbeliever, you need to know that it's foolish. It's foolish. And it goes against the word of the Lord. There's a passage from Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, where he speaks of a woman who might be remarried because of the death of a husband or something. And here's what he says exactly. He says, a woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes. But then he tacks this on the end. But he must belong to the Lord. And that was not a rule just for women. It's not really a rule at all, because we don't live by rules. But it is a principle that we should be careful to observe as the wisdom of the Lord. Paul also wrote a little bit later on in that letter to the Corinthians, that first letter, he said, do not be misled. Bad company corrupts good character. And whether or not we're dealing with a business yoking or a marriage or a friendship, to be connected on an intimate basis where you are receiving input and advice and so forth and so on is going to take its toll eventually. I cannot tell you how many times I have dealt with a marriage partner, a spouse of someone in the body or whatever, who comes to me and sits down and begins to tell me all the things that are wrong with their marriage. And before we can even begin to talk about some solutions, I will start to hear, inevitably I will hear, well, you know, I'm getting a lot of pressure from people to just divorce the guy. And so I'll say, well, who's telling you that? Well, the gals at work. Are they believers? Well, no. Duh. How do you think the world's going to react? You think they're going to follow the word? We think they're going to say, well, I wonder what the Bible says about that. No, they're going to do what they think is right. Divorce the bum. Right? Get out of the situation. Of course they're going to say that. What do you think? What are we thinking? Who are you becoming intimate with in terms of even your connectedness and fellowship, and who are you getting advice from? Because bad company corrupts good character. If you're sitting and getting all of this input from the world and you're watching the latest Doctor Whoever show, you know, telling you what and this and that and the other thing, or heaven forbid you're watching soap operas and being influenced that way, goodness gracious, we'll pray for you after the service, or whatever the case might be, or you're getting all these, I mean, movies and books and all these. Listen, you got to know that's influencing your heart. You got to know. And you're going to, when you find yourself in a situation where life just kind of goes, you know, and you're just stop dead in your tracks, and now you're facing a decision, all that input over the years is going to want to come out. And I get all these people coming and telling me about their marriage. They want to come and tell me how bad their, why, and we should never have gotten married in the first place. And I stop them right there. And I say, you know what? Whatever you can say, double goes for me. I tell them that. If it was a dumb idea for you to get married, it was dumber for me. But guess what? Here we are. And listen, just because you made a mistake back there doesn't mean it justifies making another stupid mistake right now. And so get that out of your mind right now. I don't care if you made a mistake, and neither does God. You're living right in the right now, the here and now, and it's time to walk with Christ uprightly now. And God will even take your mistakes and begin to work them through in your life. You know, I tell you, but you got to know those things come from the influence of the world. And I know what that influence is all about. I walked in it. I lived it. I promoted it on secular radio for so many years as a radio announcer. That's what I did before before God called me, you know, as a pastor. I sat in a little booth talking to myself with headphones on, but playing rock and roll music that basically conveys to people, you know, when the love is gone, there's nothing you can do about it, so just go find another one. That was the basic lyrics for most of the songs. And you think that doesn't get into people's hearts? Sure it does. Of course it does. So, it is an important thing that we do not yoke ourselves with a system of understanding whether it's coming from people or institutions or whatever, but a system of understanding that is so contrary to the Word of God that it begins to corrupt our hearts and minds in a direction that He would not have us to walk. And we need to start asking some tough questions about what's going in to our hearts, whether it's through movies or books or television shows or friends or whatever. Do not be misled. And on that perky note, we'll stop. And we'll pick it up in chapter 7, Lord willing, next time.